Hi, my name is David Foley, and I'm a liver and kidney transplant surgeon from the University of Wisconsin. And today we're going to discuss liver transplantation as a summary. The talk is going to consist of three parts. One is going to be indications for liver transplantation, and then I'll also discuss the liver allocation system based on MELD score. And then what I'll do is I'll move into the surgical aspects of liver transplantation. What are some things we think about in the transplant setting from a surgical perspective that may cause implications to the patient in the postoperative period, and also do a brief discussion on the surgical complications that can occur after liver transplantation. So liver transplantation is the treatment for end-stage liver disease, and patients who meet the criteria for end-stage liver disease are patients who develop cirrhosis. Cirrhosis can be related to a number of causes, which we won't get into all of them at this point, but some of them, the most common would be hepatitis C, alcoholic liver disease, and other cholestatic liver diseases. Patients normally meet the indications for liver transplantation when they develop complications of cirrhosis. And the complications of cirrhosis include hepatocellular dysfunction, where their hepatocytes do not function as they normally do, resulting in coagulopathy, an inability to detoxify the blood, and multiple other complications related from hepatocellular dysfunction. Patients can also develop bile duct damage from cholestatic liver disease, whether it be primary sclerosing cholangitis or primary biliary cirrhosis, that can lead to secondary cirrhosis and ultimately the need for liver transplant. And the third indication for patients with cirrhosis would be people who develop portal hypertension. And obviously the complications from portal hypertension would include ascites and potentially esophageal varices resulting in significant GI bleeding. A third indication for liver transplantation were those who develop primary hepatocellular carcinoma. Now, patients with bad cirrhosis and portal hypertension may not be candidates for liver resection due to the increased complexity and the increased morbidity after liver resection for hepatocellular carcinoma. Those patients may be eligible for liver transplantation provided they meet the certain tumor burden criteria called the Milan criteria. Patients will need to have no more than three tumors, and each of those tumors need to be less than 3 centimeters, or no more than one tumor that's no greater than 5 centimeters in diameter. If they meet the criteria for Milan, within the Milan criteria, they are able to proceed with being potentially listing candidates for liver transplantation. Two other tumors that patients are eligible for liver transplant may be cholangiocarcinoma, where the patients can undergo a neoadjuvant chemotherapy protocol followed by biopsy of periportal lymph nodes to make sure there's no extrahepatic disease, and then those patients can be listed for liver transplantation if they meet other indicated criteria. And lastly, neuroendocrine tumors that are metastatic to the liver. Patients may be eligible for liver transplantation in these settings, provided that the primary tumor is identified and resected prior to the identification of the metastatic liver disease, and those patients may be suitable candidates for liver transplantation. Deceased donor livers are allocated based on the MELD score. The MELD score is a predictor of 90-day waitlist mortality, and it's based on three laboratory data elements. Two are related to liver function, and one is related to kidney function. The INR and the total bilirubin are your liver function tests, and creatinine is your renal function tests. The patient develops a score between anywhere between 6 and 40. If your score is 6, you have a low chance of dying on the wait list waiting for a liver transplant. If your score is as high as 40, you potentially have a 95% chance of dying on the liver transplant waiting list without receiving a liver transplant. There are some patients who might have low MELD scores based on their physiologic scoring system, but may be eligible for exception scores. These patients that may be sick enough to the point where the MELD score does not reflect the severity of their disease or the potential waitlist mortality. And those patients include those who have hepatocellular carcinoma, cholangiocarcinoma, hepatopulmonary syndrome, and portal pulmonary hypertension. These are some examples of diagnoses that patients may have and be eligible for exception scores. These cases are reviewed by the regional review board in the transplant center's area, and then after approval, they receive a specific score based on their diagnosis, And usually that MELD exception score will increase 10 percentage point, correction, 10% each 3 months, every 3 months moving forward to get them a transplantable MELD score. So those are the indications and liver allocation overview. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about the surgical aspects of liver transplantation. Basically, the operation is broken down into removal of the deceased donor, of the removal of the diseased liver or hepatectomy, followed by implantation. And the implantation essentially encompasses four anastomoses: the inferior vena cava, the portal vein, the hepatic artery, and the bile duct. The hepatectomy is usually taking out, many instances, the most complicated part of the operation due to the severe portal hypertension, maybe the patient had previous abdominal surgery. These aspects increase the complexity of the hepatectomy itself. When the liver is removed, the decision is made to either remove the native vena cava with the donor liver, and therefore the implantation of the new liver would be with the cava replacement technique. Alternatively, if the decision is made to keep the native cava behind, the liver is taking off the native cava and a common orifice is made between the hepatic vein stumps in order to allow for implantation of the new liver. If the decision is made to do a cava replacement, then the entire inferior vena cava is replaced with the new liver. Therefore, an upper vena cava and a lower vena cava anastomosis will need to be performed. If the piggyback technique is undertaken, then only one inferior vena cava anastomosis is performed, and that's between the suprahepatic vena cava of the donor liver and the common orifice created between the right, middle, and left hepatic veins of the recipient. After the inferior vena cava anastomosis is completed, the portal vein anastomosis is completed. This is usually done in an end-to-end fashion between the native portal vein and the recipient portal vein. In the setting of native portal vein thrombosis, the patient in some instances will have to have a portal venous jump graft from the superior mesenteric vein extending through the transverse mesocolon and up to the recipient portal, up to the donor portal vein in an end-to-end fashion. In rare instances, if the superior mesenteric vein is thrombosed as well, the patients may be eligible for a caval portal venous inflow to the donor liver, or they may also be eligible for a renal vein decompression and use a left renal vein for inflow. The challenges with that, those techniques is that the portal venous system may not be adequately decompressed if there's no spontaneous mesocaval shunts within the mesentery, causing the patient to have continued portal hypertension after the transplant. After the portal venous anastomosis is done, we proceed with the hepatic arterial anastomosis. And the hepatic arterial anastomosis is normally done between the recipient hepatic artery at the common hepatic artery level and the donor common hepatic artery in an end-to-end fashion. However, there are some instances as well where there will be blood clot in the common hepatic artery and the patient's not eligible to have adequate inflow from his or her recipient common hepatic artery. In those instances, the patients will have to have an aortic jump graft performed. We do that by taking the donor iliac artery and we connect it to either the supraciliac or the infrarenal abdominal aorta. And then that artery is brought up to the porta hepatis and an end-to-end anastomosis is performed between the donor iliac jump graft and then the donor common hepatic artery. This is a good option for patients who don't have adequate inflow in the common hepatic artery, but one must also understand that there's an increased risk of hepatic artery thrombosis that occurs for patients who require iliac artery junk grafts from the aorta as opposed to patients who have end-to-end common hepatic arterial anastomoses. After the liver is reperfused and we've checked for significant surgical bleeding, the next approach is completion of the biliary anastomosis. Most commonly, the bile duct anastomosis is performed between the end of the common, the end of the recipient common bile duct and the donor common bile duct. That's usually the most common, called a choledochocolidocostomy. However, in some instances, the surgeon may prefer to use a Roux-en-Y hepaticojejunostomy if, in the setting of primary sclerosis and cholangitis, where there's significant disease in the recipient common bile duct, the decision is made to do a Roux-en-Y hepaticojejunostomy, where the side of the jejunum is brought up to the liver, and it's an end-to-side hepaticojejunostomy is performed between the end of the bile duct and the side of the jejunum. The advantages of doing a colidocal choledochostomy is that an ERCP can be performed after liver transplant for the treatment of any biliary stenosis at the anastomosis or the treatment of bile leaks. If the patient undergoes a hepaticojejunostomy, normally an ERCP is not able to be performed, and for the treatment of any of the biliary complications, a percutaneous transhepatic cholangiogram would need to be performed. So now I'm going to move into the complications after liver transplant. And the way we break down the complications of liver transplant would be whether or not the patient has a severe complication that may require a repeat liver transplant within the first 2 weeks. The first instance would be primary nonfunction. This occurs when we transplant a deceased donor liver, and we're not exactly sure why, but the liver does not work. The liver is not working, as manifested by persistently elevated lactate levels, persistently elevated INR, and very high aminotransferase levels with no clear evidence of recovery of function after implantation. This occurs about 1% of the time across the country, and when this occurs, the patients will be relisted on the deceased donor liver transplant as a status 1, and then the patient will receive the next available organ offer in his or her blood type from their 5-state region. Another scenario would be hepatic artery thrombosis. Hepatic artery thrombosis occurs when a blood clot develops in the hepatic artery, usually near the anastomosis. And when that occurs, it usually occurs about 1% to 2% of the time based on national data. At that point, the patient would have to go back to the operating room in many instances to undergo hepatic artery thrombectomy. However, despite the fact that blood flow can be restored in that setting, the bile ducts in the liver have sustained irreversible damage from the ischemia and in many instances requires retransplantation as well. Based on the level of the enzymes in the patient's blood, that is the AST and ALT, they can usually meet the criteria to be listed as a status 1 within the region and receive another liver transplant. Third complication that can occur is portal vein thrombosis that occurs a little bit less than 1% of the time. When that occurs, the patients do need to go back to the operating room for emergent portal venous thrombectomy. This may be due to a technical complication. Patients who have had previous portal vein thrombi and might have some abnormality in the endothelium of the portal vein, those patients undergo portal vein thrombectomy to restore portal venous blood flow to the liver. If this complication is treated in a timely manner, in many instances, the patients would not require a retransplant. The fourth group of complications would be related to the biliary anastomosis. Bile duct complications after liver transplant as a group can range anywhere between 20 to 25% of the time. These include stenosis at the anastomosis or anastomotic stricture or biliary leak with the development of a biloma outside the liver. If there's a bile leak that occurs immediately after liver transplant within the first 12 to 24 hours, one approach would be just to take the patient back to the operating room to repair the biliary leak. However, in many instances, these complications can be managed by postoperative ERCP and stent placement to control the biliary leak and to prevent any further leaking in the abdominal cavity. If there is a biloma that is present and outside of the liver after liver transplant, the patient can then undergo percutaneous drainage in interventional radiology with the placement of a drain. And lastly, in select livers where we recover from donation after circulatory death donors, in approximately anywhere between 9 to 15% of the time, patients can develop ischemic cholangiopathy from the donor process in combination with the transplant process. If patients develop severe ischemic cholangiopathy, which is beating of the bile ducts in both sides of the liver, usually the patients need to undergo retransplantation. About 87 to 88% of the patients who develop ischemic cholangiopathy will develop it within the first 90 days after DCD liver transplantation. However, there are some scenarios where a single stricture of a right or left hepatic duct can be treated with percutaneous transhepatic cholangiogram and dilatation or with ERCP and stent placement. And those patients, despite developing ischemic cholangiopathy, do not necessarily need liver retransplantation. I will conclude my talk today just discussing a little bit about enzyme liver function tests after liver transplantation. Within the first 24 to 48 hours after liver transplantation, the AST and ALT will increase due to ischemia reperfusion injury resulting from the transplant process. It is expected that these enzymes levels will go down after liver transplantation within the first 1 to 2 days. However, if those numbers continue to stay up, we do get concerned as to whether or not we're leading to primary nonfunction or whether or not the patient's developed a vascular thrombosis that needs an intervention. The bile duct enzymes, alkaline phosphatase and GGT, those enzymes can actually increase normally between days 4 and 8 after liver transplantation. When that occurs, there's not much to do and no intervention needs to be done. That's usually related to either the edema or delayed ischemia reperfusion injury of the bile duct epithelial cells. And we normally just observe those patients and do not do any intervention. However, at any point when the numbers go up after liver transplant, we do start to run the algorithm that there's something might be wrong with either blood flow, rejection, or biliary complications. And when that occurs, we usually go to a duplex ultrasound to start. A duplex ultrasound will allow us to assess the patency of the hepatic artery and portal vein. If that ends up being negative, we can then proceed with a liver transplant biopsy to rule out acute cellular rejection in the early post-transplant period. And if that ends up being negative and the numbers are still elevated, we do get concerned about a potential biliary complication, and the patients may be eligible or it may be a good indication to proceed with the RCP at that time point. Another thing to remember about liver function tests after liver transplantation is when the total bilirubin is elevated, one needs to think of an underlying infection that might be independent from any blood flow to the liver. The liver may be working well, but any evidence of extrahepatic infection can also lead to an elevation in total bilirubin and a subsequent workup with the appropriate fever workup that you normally do in any post-surgical patient. So I'll conclude my talk today by just saying that this is an overview of liver transplantation. We discussed the indications, the allocation system based on MELD score, the surgical techniques involved in liver transplantation, and the complications that can occur after liver transplantation in order to perform the appropriate evaluation and get the optimal outcome for the patient.